Can I just, I don't remember.
Good afternoon. My name is Suzanne. I'm a compulsive overeater and food addict. Hi. Thanks for, Merrill, thanks for asking me here today. I'm passing around this picture of me. This was taken 2 months before I came back in the rooms to stay. I first came into OA back in 1988. I was like two. No. I was young. But it was certainly for a diet. And my recovery has been plagued with relapse. So in 2010, I came back to stay. I have some more pictures up here, but I'm going to... Can you grab my coat?
Yep.
I have something in the pocket that I want to show everybody. Okay. All right, but today, I could talk about a lot of different things, but today I'm going to talk to you about how I got abstinent and how I stay abstinent. Thanks. And I'm also going to share, talk to you about my higher power in a rather specific way. And I know not everyone here shares my convictions, so please take what you like and leave the rest. So to get abstinent, I heard Emmy share about being desperate. And for me, I really needed to be desperate. I had to be desperate enough to want to change. And that's not easy. And I'm not talking about changing the way I looked. I had fantasies about being transplanted into a model's body so many times. I can't even tell you. But then I would, of course, I'm the obsessive person, so I would sit there and think it all the way through. Okay, well, would my memory go with it? And would I then be able to go back and raise my son, or would she take over, or how's this work, you know? But no, that's not the change that I needed. I needed to change how I lived, what I did, how I thought, how I felt, what I believed. So for me to get to that point where I was desperate enough to change, I had to get very sick. I had to be convinced that I was beaten. I had to be in a lot of pain, fear, and discomfort. I wished I'd figured this out sooner, but I suffer from another condition. It's called, I want to do it myself-itis. And no matter how many times somebody tells me not to touch the stove or I'll get burned, and they can show me the burns on their hands, I still have to reach out and touch that damn stove. And then I have to touch it again just to make sure the first time wasn't a fluke. So, my self-will is a powerful thing. Okay. So... Though I was in the rooms and I heard all the horror stories of people who had gotten really obese and had very significant health issues, I saw myself as different from them. And I was different. They had just been at it longer. I was just newer into the program. And what I didn't see that they were showing me my future. Had I been able to believe that I had an incurable progressive disease that gets worse over time, never better, I might have been able to spare myself some of the pain and the damage that I did. But I didn't, because I want to do it myself, I just. Instead, I had to put my hand on that stove and get over, well over 300 pounds, have high blood pressure, sleep apnea, not be able to fit in airplane seats or in bathroom stalls, have trouble wiping myself, washing myself, tying my shoes, getting in and out of cars. It was incredible what I got myself to. The physical toll that it took on me for every year that I was in super obesity, and that, for those of you who don't know, that's the level above morbid obesity, which is, you know, worse than people that are too heavy that they'll die from it. So how can that be worse? Well, I guess maybe just die sooner. That's what I figure. But that's where I was at. But I used to joke about it. I used to say that I had the best retirement plan going because I wasn't going to live to see retirement, so I didn't have to save for it. So then I could indulge in my spending, which was another issue. I had resigned myself to an early death, and I sat back and ate my way towards that reality. And how sad is that? And I know that there are so many people in this room that understand exactly what I'm talking about. And those of you that don't, you just don't yet. So one day, thank you God, I got scared enough to want to change. Once I made that choice, the choice to live and not to die, I had to get help, because the first thing I had to change was believing that I could do it under my own power. Like I tried time and time again. During all the diets I tried, whether it was by watching what I ate, joining a commercial diet program, and I've tried them all more than once, exercising in a way, taking laxatives or water pills or appetite suppressants, both legal and illegal, restricting my food, etc., etc., etc. I spent 30 years trying to find that one way that I could make it work, and I failed to have any long-term success. So I knew I couldn't do this. I also knew that the answer was OA, because my experience in the rooms had been that it showed me that that was the only time that I'd ever truly been free from the obsession. When I've had times that I've been free from the obsession, the only time was in the rooms. And I knew that I wanted to be free from that obsession. And to me, that was the thing that was driving me, that was the thing that was bothering me the most. It wasn't the weight anymore, because I'd already figured out that I was going to die okay. But I just wanted to have one moment freed from that food obsession. You know, those food voices were in my head 24/7. It was crazy. So at the time I came back in, I had been in relapse for just over a year. But in that time, I had started to work on my relationship with my higher power. I was raised a Catholic. I left the church when I was in college. I spent many years adrift. I dabbled in Buddhism. And then I was an agnostic for many years before I got drawn back into my religion of origin. But like Bill Wilson says in the Big Book, and I quote, "To Christ, I conceded the certainty of a great man, not too closely followed by those who claim him. His moral teaching most excellent. For myself, I had adopted those parts which seemed convenient and not too difficult. The rest I disregarded." So I could relate to what Bill had to say with that. But I found myself one day utterly desperate, and I knew I had to get back to OA. But for me to be in the rooms meant that I had to put down the food, because I am not strong enough to be in the rooms and in the food. I would be driven out by the guilt and the shame of it. So I knew that I had to put down the food. And to put down the food, I had to get those food voices out of my head, because it was just like something that drove me to the food time and time again. So I knelt by the side of the bed, and in tears, I prayed out loud, and I asked Jesus if he was real, if he had any power at all, to please give me relief from these food voices. And in that instant, the voices ceased. It was like a TV that had been on for 24/7 for 30 years had suddenly been turned off. And I was overwhelmed by the evidence of God's power. It was like a force in the room with me. That night, I went to a meeting, I got a sponsor, and I started working the steps. I immediately took action. I was willing to surrender the food. Then 10 days later, I picked up. And that really scared me, because all the other times I'd been in the rooms, I always had at least a few months of recovery, maybe sometimes as much as several months. And I knew that death was waiting for me outside the rooms. I mean, that was my reality. I was going to push over 400 pounds. I was there. I was utterly defeated. I was scared to death. So once again, I threw myself on my knees, and I cried the prayer of a desperate, dying woman. And I asked Jesus once again for help. I begged for help. And I said that whatever he asked of me, whatever he needed of me, anything that he needed of me, I would do it. He had me. I was his. So I surrendered myself to him totally, holding nothing back. I mean, it was like I had peeled myself open to the core of my being, and I just let him in. And I was instantly filled with a peace that I have never known. That hole that I'd been trying to fill with food all those years wasn't filled. I mean, it was just gone. I was complete. I was loved. And that was November 4th, 2010. I've been blessed with abstinence from substances of addiction ever since. And for me, that's refined carbohydrates which is includes all forms of sugar and flour. Those are things I just cannot have. So while the obsession had been miraculously lifted, my body was still going through withdrawal. And make no mistake about it, this disease is powerful, baffling, cunning, baffling, and powerful. I had the taste of sugar in my mouth for several days, and it would reemerge from time to time over the next several months. I had food dreams for nearly a year, so vivid that sometimes I woke crying that I had broken my abstinence and thanking God when I found out that it was just a dream. Sometimes I just stand in front of the refrigerator for no reason at all. Other than maybe I was bored or upset or happy or whatever, you know. But it was a very hard habit to break. It was my go-to thing, you know. Time and time again, that's what I did. But I didn't eat those substances no matter what. I couldn't. Because they're death to me. They're poison to me. I cannot have them. I got immersed in reading the big book. I understood the nature of the illness, the allergy of the body, and the obsession of the mind. I was convinced that I cannot even have a little bit of these substances. And I'll share a little side story. I had one of the things that I would have in part of my food plan were peanuts. And I'd like sometimes, not every day, but sometimes, if I did, I'd have like a tablespoon of the peanuts on my salad or whatever. And I always got dry roasted peanuts because the only thing in it is peanuts. And I always bought like the store brand. So I was shopping in a different store. They didn't have a store brand. So I got the Planters dry roasted peanuts. And I just put them in my cart. And shortly after that, I was starting to feel hungry again. And I was starting to get irritated again. And I was, like, my emotions were starting to feel really, like, flammable, as all I can say. And I started having a lot of food thoughts again, and I wasn't understanding what was going on. I was sharing this with my sponsor, and she said, well, you know, your sister's been visiting from Australia, so your schedule's off. And you guys just had an earthquake and a hurricane, so, you know, maybe there's something, it's stress, you know, it's stress-related. I said, yeah, okay. So I was trying to do more meetings, more prayer, drink water, blah, blah, all that kind of stuff. But this was still sticking with me. So I go in the cabinet, pull out the peanuts, and it's turned around, and I look, and there's like all these lines under ingredients, and I'm like, what? I hadn't read the label, and it said, contains peanuts and less than 2% of blah, 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 sugar, blah, 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 blah. And I was like, son of a bitch. For 10 days, I'd been ingesting a trace amount of sugar, and it was rocking my world. So that, more than anything, more than anybody telling me that I have a problem with it, more than the feeling of clarity that I got when I put it down, that told me I'm addicted to this substance. I can't have even a little bit of it. And if I pick it up, I can't stop eating with the help of human aid. And that includes myself and the fellowship. Because the fellowship is not going to save me from an act of addiction. Only God can do that. And I firmly believe this. But the fellowship leads me to the steps. And the steps lead me to God. And God saves me. So that's how that works for me. What I had to do for the first 2 to 4 weeks of my abstinence, I compare it to somebody preparing their home for like a direct hit of a hurricane. I took it seriously. I knew that my life depended upon having a recovery plan. I gathered the resources that I needed and I used them. This included a sponsor who I called every day. Meetings I attended 3 to 4 times a week. Phone numbers of people I called between meetings. Literature that I read every day. Prayer and meditation that I did daily. And immediately working the steps, which involved writing and sharing this with my sponsor. And that seems like a lot of work, but let me tell you, the time and energy I spent into keeping my disease active was a lot more than that, because I did that 24/7. This I don't do 24/7. I mean, not the work part of it. I looked for signs of trouble, and I have responded so I could avoid further damage. If I was getting hungry or hit with withdrawal symptoms, I prayed for relief. I went for a walk, I had a meeting, I called somebody, I drank water, I told myself, this too shall pass. I knew I wasn't going to starve if I didn't eat X, Y, or Z. And that it was somebody said, you know, you're not going to starve if you don't eat for an hour. And I was like, all right, you got me there, you know. If my family was annoying me, I removed myself from their presence. I had to have strong words with my parents to draw definite boundaries with them regarding my program activities and my food plan. I remember going over, they would want me to come over for dinner, and I would go over and I would ask them, what are you making? How are you making it? And they would tell me, and I said, okay, and I put that into my food plan for the day. And then I'd get there, and my dad had added some sauce, or added this, or, well, there's just a tablespoon of brown sugar in the whatever. I'm like, well, I can't eat that. And if I can't eat that, that's the protein that you had prepared. I'm gonna have to go. I can't have dinner with you guys. Really? Yeah. But there's only a little bit of it. I'm like, how many times do I have to tell you? I cannot have any of this. Period. It's a matter of life and death for me. I cannot have it. And if you're going to do this, I can't come and have dinner with you. I love you, but goodbye. And I left. And it stunned them. But after that, now my dad, he's like, okay, well, the recipe calls for this. I'm going to add a little bit of it. Is that okay? Yeah, that's okay, Dad. Can you do dill? I mean, is dill okay? Yeah, Dad, dill's okay. Yeah. So, you know, he really runs things by me when I go over there for dinner, which is great. But I put my recovery first before everything else, which means everything and everyone. If anything or anyone threatened me not being able to do something I needed to do for my recovery, they lost to my program. I stopped going out to dinner with non-OA friends for a while till I could handle it. I missed family functions when there was an OA function I was attending instead. I left family functions early when they started to talk too much about food or do other dysfunctional things that made me uncomfortable. My abstinence was like a seedling that needed tender care until it took root and grew stronger. It's important for me to make it the very top priority in my life. That's how I got abstinent. Desperation, conviction that my way won't work, belief that God will help me, surrendering to God, protecting what I'm given with all my might. This sure sounds like steps 1, 2, and 3. So how I stay abstinent is no secret. It's all the other steps. And I won't go into detail about steps 4 through 9, but I do want to address them a little bit. So there's crap that happened in my life, and there's crap I did to people in my life. And some of this stuff I still carry around as hurts, angers, fears, guilt, remorse, shame, all that stuff. And I would relive it every time that I was reminded of all the crap that I did or somebody did to me. So in the past, whenever I felt that way, I always turned to food. That was my go-to. You know? But in this program, I can work the steps instead of turning to the food. So I had to work steps 4 through 9 to get rid of all that stuff that had come before. Clean slate. Step 10, that keeps that slate clean. And step 10 is really nothing more than steps 4 through 9 on something that happened. And I do it at, you know, right when it's happening or right after it happens, so it doesn't fester. So great. I surrendered. God's helping me. I'm facing my past. I cleaned up all the wreckage. My character defects have been removed, or at least I'm living as if they've been removed. And maybe that's a secret nobody's told you about step 6 and 7. Our character defects are not miraculously removed like abracadabra. We have to live as if they have been removed. Step 6 says we have to be entirely ready to have God remove our defects. And that means being willing to live without them. Yeah, okay, I'll let you remove them. That means, okay, I'll do without it. And so we have to act as if they've been. For me, procrastination is one of the problems that I have. And that means living like I don't have procrastination. For me, that's living one day at a time. Because if I live in today, I don't have a tomorrow that I can put things off to. And I know that the more I do this, one day I will wake up and I won't be a procrastinator because I will just be doing the things today that I can do today. It does not take a big upheaval to change major character defects. It takes small steps each day. And if you ever saw that movie Contact with Jodie Foster, there's this scene where the dad says to her, "Small moves, Ellie, small moves," when she's trying to find the stars in her telescope. And that's what it's like for me in changing. It's small moves every day. So now things which used to baffle me, I can handle with ease. My life's getting better. In fact, I've had some amazing experiences that I would have had had I not been in recovery. I was able to go skydiving. And I was never able to do this. My brother and sister would do it because I was over the weight limit. But finally, I wasn't over the weight limit anymore, so I could do skydiving. I participated in a triathlon as part of a relay team. And this is my prop, one of my props. We took third place.
Wow.
So that was pretty awesome. And also, I entered and I finished the MS 150, the finisher's medal for that, which means I biked 160 miles in 2 days. These are all things that there is no way I would have been able to do them without the recovery that I have. First of all, I hated exercise. Hated it. Hated it. And I hated people that exercised. I'd be like, all right, you look good in your spandex, so what, you know. But one day I was traveling back from Virginia visiting my sister, and it's funny because I had been on a plateau with my physical recovery for a good 3 or 4 months at that point. And I knew I had to do something different to get different results. And for me, my physical recovery is a form of service. It's not vanity. It's like, this is a program of attraction, not promotion. So I need to do whatever I can to maximize the physical recovery, I guess. I don't know. To get to where God wants me, basically. So I knew that meant I had to exercise, and I knew I didn't want to do it. So I used the Increase My Desire prayer, you know, and I just asked God, please increase my desire to exercise, please increase my desire to exercise. I did that like a mantra the entire ride home from Virginia, which is about 2.5-3 hours. That night, go to sleep, you know, I don't feel any different. The next day, I wake up and I'm thinking about, maybe I want to join the gym. And that feeling grows in me and grows in me all through the day to where I'm talking to people about it at work. I'm like, you know, I'm thinking of joining the gym. And then that evening, I'm going and I'm picking out some exercise clothes. I find myself finding a bag to put them in, and I'm like, what am I doing? And that night, I'm resolved. The next morning, I go to the Y, I join the Y, and I started exercising, and I've been doing it ever since. And you can see where it got me. And that was from prayer, you know, and being willing to do whatever God wanted me to do. But as the big book says on page 15, for if an alcoholic or compulsive overeater failed to perfect and enlarge his spiritual life through work and self-sacrifice for others, he could not survive the certain trials and low spots ahead. If he did not work, he would surely drink again, and if he drank, he would surely die. So in step 11, we seek through prayer and meditation to improve our conscious contact with God as we understand him, seeking only knowledge of his will for us and the power to carry that out. On pages 86 and 87 of the big book, it explains this further. And I am going to... I'm terrible about time. Again, procrastination, whatever. And it says, When we retire at night, we constructively review our day. Were we resentful, selfish, dishonest, or afraid? Do we owe an apology? Have we kept something to ourselves which should be discussed with another person at once? Were we kind and loving toward all? What could we have done better? Were we thinking of ourselves most of the time, or were we thinking of what we could do for others, of what we could pack into the stream of life? But we must be careful not to drift into worry, remorse, or morbid reflection, for that would diminish our usefulness to others. After making our review, we ask God's forgiveness and inquire what corrective measures should be taken. Pretty clear-cut directions. Ask me about what to do at night. On awakening, let us think about the 24 hours ahead. Not next week, not next year, not 10 years from now, 24 hours. We consider our plans for the day. Before we begin, we ask God to direct our thinking, especially asking that it be divorced from self-pity, dishonest, or self-seeking motives. Under these conditions, we can employ our mental faculties with assurance. For after all, God gave us brains to use. Our thought life will be placed on a much higher plane when our thinking is cleared of wrong motives. So that's what we do in the morning. So what do we do all day in between? Oh, it tells us. In thinking about our day, we may face indecision. We may not be able to determine which course to take. Here we ask God for inspiration, an intuitive thought, or a decision. We relax and take it easy. We don't struggle. We are often surprised how the right answers come after we have tried this for a while. What used to be the hunch or the occasional inspiration gradually becomes a working part of the mind. Being still inexperienced and having just made conscious contact with God, it is not probable that we are going to be inspired at all times. We might pay for this presumption in all sorts of absurd actions and ideas. Nevertheless, we find that our thinking will, as time passes, be more and more on the plane of inspiration. We come to rely upon it. So, these are really great paragraphs. Page 86 and 87 highlight the whole thing. It's great. And you can see in those simple paragraphs, if you just did what they say, it'll change your life. It will change your life. And I know that when I seek God's will instead of Suzanne's will, and I follow it, I won't cause harm to myself or those around me. So nothing to clean up, nothing to eat over. When I follow Suzanne's will, it's a crapshoot. And chances are, I'm gonna hurt myself at a minimum. And it is a daily battle. But I'd rather be battling that, my will, than the food. And this is a picture somebody shared with me. You can see it. This is me. I'm the mouse. And the cheese is whatever it is that I am after, you know. And that helmet is me thinking, you know, I got another way to do this. I got a way around it. I got a door number two. I figured out the trick. No, it doesn't work. I have to surrender the cheese. That's the whole thing. So now I'm honestly seeking God's will and trying to follow this on a daily basis. And this brings me to step 12. Having had a spiritual awakening as a result of these steps, it means I'm not operating under my old beliefs. I'm operating with new beliefs, living in a spiritual world, not in the material world, the world of self. We tried to carry this message to compulsive overeaters. It doesn't mean that we succeeded, but we try. And to practice these principles in all our affairs, not some areas of my life, in all areas of my life. And that was something that I learned, you know, oh, there's another thing that I have to surrender? Oh my gosh. So, and I'll go into that a little bit. I am not perfect, far, far from it. In fact, this past year, I've been battling my self-will in another area of my life, in relationships. A year ago, I determined I was ready to start dating again. And so I went online to find the right man. I tried so many different things. I used only one side, I used multiple sides, I used happy pictures and active pictures and provocative pictures and short profiles and long profiles, and we did the emailing and the texting and the phone calls and the coffee dates and real dates, and it all ended up the same way. Frustration and pain. it wasn't working. Nothing was working. I even bought a book that told me the right way to do internet dating, and I followed all the rules, and it still turned out the same way. It's me, the mouse, you know, trying to find another way to do it, what I wanted to do. And I prayed about it to God very often, but he was seemed silent on the matter. I was like, knock, knock, where are you? Then I started to pray that he would just take the wheel, you know, go ahead, steer the course. I'll let you take direction on this. And when I would do that, when I would pray, you know, about that, and I'm not kidding, like 5 or 10 minutes after I said that prayer, there would be a guy that would come across, you know, that I would bump into, and he'd start talking with me very easily, and he was really nice, and then he'd go on his way, and I'd be like, was he the one? You know? But then I would realize, no, it was just God showing me, it's like that. I can bring somebody into your life just like that. You don't have to work so hard. This isn't your job, you know. So he can bring somebody across my path that easily. I don't have to make it happen myself. I don't have to suffer from I can do it myself-itis. I just need to get out there and live my life. But this had to happen 3 times before I finally heard him. And I finally did turn this over to God yet again. Another thing to turn over. I will follow his path from you, walk his path, whatever it is, wherever that's going to lead me. I don't know if I'm going to have a partner someday or not. That's up to him to decide. I knew my way wasn't working. But yet I was still having some apprehension that God wouldn't give me what I wanted, and I might have to spend 30 or 40 years without a partner, and I was really sad about that. But God took care of that too in a very beautiful way. And I'll share that with you. During a meditation at our Firelight speaker meeting last weekend, I was pondering how long I was going to have to wait for God who's going to bring somebody to me, blah, 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 blah. And all of a sudden I had this booming thought come into my head. How do you know how long you have? And I realized I'd been assuming I was going to have 30 or 40 years, but I could die next week. I travel some very busy roads. I also bike on very busy roads, so it could happen, right? It's true. I don't know how much time I have. You don't know how much time you have. None of us knows how much time we have. The only thing I do know is I have today. That's all I have. Today is the only day I can live. But I do have peace today. And I'm okay to be without a guy today. I can let go of the future. Once I realize that I only have to worry about today, I don't have to worry about next week. I don't have to worry about next year. I live today. It's funny, I used to think, like, if I found out I only had, like, 3 months to live, I would sit there and think about all the things I would cram into the time I had left, and I was going to do all this, and I was going to blah, 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 blah. But now, like, just even contemplating the thought that I might only have a week left to live, I don't feel the need to cram anything into today. Today is sufficient in and of itself. I just live today the best way I can. And one of the greatest things I have in my day-to-day was coming here and meeting all of you. And I can enjoy the birds in the sky and the colors and nature and the flow of traffic and the singing of the birds and the smiles of other people and laughter of kids. I mean, there's just so many things that I can notice today because today is perfect day. I treat myself gently today. I love myself today. For to me, tomorrow never comes. I only ever have today. And I'll leave you with some words from one of my favorite songs, Live Like You Are Dying by Tim McGraw, who wrote the song after his father's death from brain cancer. In it he sings, someday I hope you get the chance to live like you were dying, like tomorrow was a gift and you had eternity to think about what you'd do with it. What could you do with it? Every day is precious. Thank you for sharing part of yours with me.
Questions or things to share?
I'm crying.